Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, our week-long spotlight on the modern workforce continues with a conversation about tipping and its class-specific roots.
And why some people are able to laugh off the image known as the sleepy Mexican rather than be insulted by it.
But first, President-elect Donald Trump has promised mass deportations of undocumented immigrants in his new administration. And now he's appointed former acting ICE head Tom Homan as his so-called border czar and South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem as the head of the Department of Homeland Security to help him do it. This week, there have been headlines about potential workplace raids and fear in immigrant communities. For many here in Arizona, it all stirs up memories of longtime Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio and workplace raids carried out on the nightly news, racial profiling lawsuits, and Department of Justice investigations. Well, our next guest says sheriff's roles in deportations in this country goes back to the 1990s. Jessica Pishko is a lawyer, journalist, and author of the new book, The Highest Law in the Land. And she told me that is when the country changed the way it handled immigration in response to the war on drugs. For the first time, most people who ended up in deportation proceedings got there through the county jail. So sheriffs are likely to play a big role in President-elect Donald Trump's promised mass deportations. I spoke with her more about what that might look like.
The thing about this style of immigration enforcement is that because local law enforcement has a lot of discretion, both in who they pull over and then what they decide to do after they pull those people over, the immigration process can look different depending on who's doing it. So, for example, when Joe Arpaio was sheriff, one of the things he did do was, in essence, racial profiling. So he pulled over a lot of drivers who looked Latino, and he might pull them over for a broken taillight, for failing to signal, for some other kind of traffic violation. Then he would often check to see if that person had their driver's license. This is a really common tactic that local law enforcement use to see if someone might be eligible for deportation, because most of the time, people who aren't documented don't have driver's licenses. So if someone didn't have a driver's license, that was an infraction that you could arrest them for. Now, once arrested, you're in police custody. And at that point, they can run your name through databases. So this was actually an invention of Barack Obama. It was called Secure Communities. Yeah. And it's basically just a really large federal database of individuals who might have warrants out, who might have been previously deported, who might have some issue with their immigration status. And that was where Joe Arpaio and other sheriffs as well can then move that person into deportation proceedings. Now, there's a lot of steps along the way, and of course, there's also a lot of discretion involved. So
Let me ask about the discretion aspect there, right? Like, and ICE's role in this. Like, at this point, and pending any change that may come from an incoming Trump administration, does ICE always respond? Do they always deport a person who could be deportable?
So they do not. Because ICE cannot simply pick up every single person in every single jail who might be deportable, there's a few different ways to get around it. One of those is a program called 287G, which Joe Arpaio also used. It deputizes sheriff's deputies to act sometimes as immigration agents, which basically means they can question people about their immigration status and put them into deportation proceedings. But also, the truth is, ICE just simply doesn't come all the time. And most of the time, sheriffs or other local law enforcement prioritize by looking at people who have been accused of serious crimes. That was the quote unquote felons, not families, right? They would focus on people who had committed usually crimes with a sentence of over a year. So serious assaults, robberies, that sort of thing. So in general, that is how it works right now.
Right. So that's what it looks like now. Let's talk about what it might look like under a Trump administration that's carrying out mass deportations that we're hearing promises of. I wonder, this will become a big question, right? Like, can the federal government force local law enforcement, local sheriffs, local police agencies to cooperate with ICE, to turn people over to ICE?
So under the mass deportation system, right, one of the things that could happen is that priorities will shift. Now, Tom Homan, who is likely to be the next head of ICE, has said that he is going to focus on quote unquote people who commit crimes. And so one of the things that I do think will happen is that this same method of, in essence, targeting people who have been arrested by local law enforcement will continue and perhaps will be amped up. During the Biden administration, many sheriffs left the 287G program. Some of them started to participate less in deportations. But this is something that the federal government can quickly ramp up because it's an already existing program. And in particular, county sheriffs who want to look like they are cooperating with the Trump administration, that want to show their constituents that they are, you know, quote, very serious about public safety, about reducing crime that may or may not be committed by immigrants. This is something that they will join, which they did during the first Trump administration, to kind of show their bona fides.
Okay. So let's talk about what this might look like in Arizona, in particular under a new immigration law that voters just passed pretty overwhelmingly, Prop 314. This is not going into effect anytime soon. It is similar to SB 4 in Texas. But as we've had that discussion with law enforcement, with sheriffs leading up to this vote in Arizona, many of them say we don't have the resources to carry this out, to be immigration agents, essentially.
And here's the thing. Sheriffs, when they don't really agree with a law, will always say that the reason they don't agree with it is because they don't have the resources, right? And that's a question of prioritization. So when, for example, states ask county sheriffs to enforce firearm registration laws or, you know, bump stock bans when those were in effect, sheriffs who didn't want to enforce those said, I don't have the resources to enforce firearm regulations. And so similarly, you know, when immigration laws come up, sheriffs will say, I don't have the resources to enforce those. And to be fair, for a lot of counties on the border, a lot of rural counties, they do not have large staff. They may not be interested in using their time to specifically target immigrants for deportation, right? I think in a lot of places, these sheriffs are also elected by constituents who don't want them doing that. So Arizona, like Texas, and also like Iowa and Oklahoma, have these state laws, which in essence are attempting to require local law enforcement not only to cooperate with ICE, but also to use their resources specifically to target immigrants. And of course, as you pointed out, right, the Texas bill is currently being litigated in court. So these bills in Iowa and Oklahoma and Arizona are all on pause because people are trying to sort out what they mean.
Yeah. Okay. One other thing I want to ask you about, Jessica, before I let you go, is the new Maricopa County Sheriff-elect, Jerry Sheridan. He was a deputy of Joe Arpaio, but he has talked very openly about immigration arrests and says, I don't want to do that, attempt to enforce immigration law. What do you make of his role and what it might look like going forward?
Joe Arpaio just did an immense number of immigration sweeps and very, very publicly on TV. So he was doing it brazenly and out in the open.
Yeah.
I think that Jerry Sheridan is simply not interested in courting that kind of litigation that ultimately ended up with the department, right, under a consent decree. I mean, he is still operating under a Department of Justice consent decree, so he cannot say that he will violate the law at this point. On the flip side, Jerry Sheridan has expressed an interest in reopening Tent City. He has said that he would like to detain more people. So I think that it remains to be seen exactly what he'll do. But I do think that what he's trying to promise is basically enough compliance with the law to get out from under the consent decree, but he also appears to be very willing to bring back a lot of the same policies that Joe Arpaio used.
All right. We'll leave it there for now. Jessica Pishko, a lawyer, journalist, and author of the new book, The Highest Law in the Land, talking to us about sheriffs and mass deportations. Jessica, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
We also reached out to Sheriff-elect Jerry Sheridan and hope to have him on the show soon to talk about these issues as well.
You've probably seen the image known as the Sleepy Mexican, a man wearing a sombrero sitting down with his knees in his chest, sleeping. It's been used over the years to portray a negative stereotype of Mexicans as lazy. But it wasn't always that way, and it isn't always seen that way now. Maribel Alvarez is a professor in the University of Arizona School of Anthropology and the Southwest Center. She joins me to talk more about all this. And Maribel, let's start with where this image actually came from.
The origins are three different moments in time, if you will. The first is really as a function of travel logs. Americans travel to Mexico late 19th century. They go to the plazas and they begin to see indigenous men and women who at the time of day when the heat is coming on will take a rest and will lean against an adobe wall, will put up a sarape and rest. This becomes a curious observation of the travelers, and it gets recorded in publications that make it back to the United States. That's the first reference. Then we begin to see, as Mexico independence comes on full bore, and the indigenista movement, the movement of painters and artists to elevate and uplift the indigenous communities of Mexico. You see Diego Rivera capture an image of a man wrapped in a blanket, crouching in a field. The idea there is one of exaltation and not one of stereotype, just the contrary, affiliating the image with hard work. And then a momentous occasion happens when one sculptor who was part of this movement of the great murals of Mexico, the great revolutionary period. It's a Colombian sculptor who's actually in residence in Mexico by the name of Romulo Rosso, creates a sculpture that is exactly the image as we know it today of the sleeping Mexican, puts it in an exhibit in the National Library, and a reporter mocks the image. And then immediately the next day, the image that has been the sculpture of this renowned artist gets plagiarized and turned into the infamous stereotype that then we know today.
So does it seem as though there's any rhyme or reason to the evolution for how this is seen, or what, you know, what people look at this image and think about?
Mark, the context here is everything. Take in consideration the fact that the image appears from an impulse of exaltation of the peons, of the ones who have been rejected, the indigenous laboring force of Mexico, with no intentions of reading into it anything else than dedication, dignity, hard labor. But the context is one in which the United States is contending with its Mexican quote-unquote problem. So you begin to see the image become the subject of ridicule. That's across the border. In Mexico itself, you have to provide the context of class struggle. The fact that there were some people intending on uplifting the indigenous populations of Mexico meant that there was an entire class that was deriding that effort and thinking that that was a foolish attempt to redeem a history of Mexico, indigenizing its history. So it was immediately fodder for both sides that were looking for a way of representing the Mexican in a way that was less than dignified.
It's so interesting because, as you referenced, the earliest depictions were based on what people were actually seeing with their own eyes. And then it sort of became this sort of stereotypical and not particularly pleasant representation, like something that was not necessarily seen as a favorable image to people.
That's one of the things that attracted me to study the image for the last 20 years. Some people, even on social media, say, like, why would you have the image of a lazy Mexican when Mexicans are exactly the opposite, a labor force in every aspect of society? So this conundrum of our representation, our ideologies plaster onto something that factually contradicts it, it's of course what has driven me to pursue its study.
Yeah. So where are we now in terms of what this image represents, maybe both in the U.S. and in Mexico?
There's always been a class divide. There's always been a Mexican elite, a Chicano intellectual elite that has always felt offended in a deep sense about the image as imputed and used in racist representations by American companies. And this followed, of course, the 1960s, 70s, and 80s rebellion against the Frito Bandito and the Señoritas, hot, fiery chili peppers, all of these imputed stereotypes. At the same time, working class folks have always had, in my experience doing ethnographic work and in many other sources, even on social media, you can see it, people feeling like, why are you offended when that's so obviously not us? So you see the working class humor, the rascuachismo, if you will, that says it's hilarious, but it's absurd. And in that absurdity, we don't recognize ourselves. And not going to the offense as much as to the absolute perplexity with what one person told me is the gringo mindset that will see something where it actually is contradicted by our own presence, our labor, the food that they eat every day. So this class divide is something that is less felicitous to talk about when it comes to the way in which the image circulates among Mexican American, as well as central Mexico elite versus working class or rural Mexican communities.
Is that what allows, for example, a Mexican restaurant to include this image on its sign or on its menu, or, you know, a gift shop of, you know, goods from Mexico to include, you know, little sculptures of this?
Absolutely. And that context is what also determines a lot of the reactions that you have seen in protests. There are restaurants right here in Tucson, very popular ones owned by Mexican American families that absolutely have that image on the door, on their logos. Mm-hmm. And the association there, in their minds, there's no contradiction. It's a place of rest. It's a place of nurturing. You also saw it as a trademark appear in the United States patio industry when you have pavers that had that image produced in the Southwest beginning in the 1950s. And the idea, again, was in the patio you relax, in the restaurant you relax. Where it becomes out of context is when cities to do cutesy tourism promotion, self-promotion, may invite a representation, and then an artist with no clue of this history, with no understanding of the divides that exist within a community, may use the image apparently innocently, but not realizing that who is advancing the image, who is speaking for its humor or its derision, has a lot to do with whether you will invite controversy or not.
Maribel Alvarez is a professor in the University of Arizona School of Anthropology and the Southwest Center. More of our conversation in a moment. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, a new show at ASU examines the feeling of longing.
But first, let's return now to my conversation with Maribel Alvarez from the University of Arizona about the history and meaning of the image known as the Sleepy Mexican. And Maribel, I'm so fascinated by the concept of people being able to look at something that others use as a stereotype for them and be able to separate themselves from it, whether it's this image or any other, that someone can try to demean someone else and that person can say, yeah, that's not me. I don't really know what you're talking about.
Absolutely. This is one of the ways in which stereotypes are both intriguing, dangerous, but potentially fruitful in the sense that they reveal what is the underneath. They reveal the lack of context or relationality. When you look at how stereotypes are used inside groups, versus outside groups, there's always a thread that connects the meaning to a life story that is already feeling dignified in its storytelling and therefore can laugh at it because it's not coming from a place of lack or deficit. From the outside, it's very difficult to bridge that and live the space of authenticity of the experience, and that's where we get into trouble all the time. Now, having said that, Mark, the levels of outrage that sometimes get manifested around these controversies on social media, on Instagram, for example, that takes it to another level. That is just a deep offense that is of our time. It's a phenomenon of the outrage of our times. And I have found that those conversations tend to be as flat, even when they are protesting the stereotype, as flat and as uninspiring as some of the most of the real racist offensive remarks.
And I guess we should be clear here. I would imagine, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that there are actually people who are offended by this image. It's not everybody laughs it off and says, "Oh, that's clever that they're trying to say this is about us, but it's not really about us. We know better." Is it safe to say that there are actually people who are still currently offended by this?
Oh, absolutely. There are reactions to the image, but I think that the last 25 years have brought a greater depth of image and visual literacy. And you have artists like Judy Baca, the amazing LA-based Chicana artist, who have taken the offense in a different direction. They have taken the body of this sculpture to be a canvas of telling the story of Mexican labor, for example. And they use it and reproduce the form. You see the sleepy Mexican with the head down and the sombrero and the breaking back, and using that as a form to tell a narrative of empowerment, of dignity. That's past the offense.
Do you find that this is the kind of image that people have tried to sort of reclaim and take ownership of, as opposed to allowing it to be a negative stereotype of them as it has been, but really sort of take ownership of and maybe take the power out of it?
Yes, we have seen that in a new generation. I encountered that here in Arizona when in 2010 the SB 1070 bill was fighting ethnic studies and Mexican American studies, and the Club Unidos at Tucson High School designed a t-shirt with a sleeping Mexican sitting and had the phrase, the caption, "Think again." And when you look at the second plane of the artwork, somewhat crude representation included that sleeping Mexican lifting up his head and reading one of the forbidden books from the ethnic studies controversy.
What do you see as the relationship, if any, around this image and all the conversation around it and the current rhetoric about immigration and immigrants in this country?
It's one of those moments where you think, how did we become so culturally literate and at the same time these resignifying messages got away from us? Meaning, how is it possible that someone could still speak about Mexican immigrants and the labor force in this country and the trade relationship of labor products that crosses the border every day only in one dimension of illegality? Of criminality. Where this disconnect happened between more information, more literacy, more access, and less knowledge and less wisdom in parsing those things out. And how could that even be possible? By asking that question, I'm asking a question a lot of people are asking. How did we get here? We should know better, and we know better, and the young people know better. A lot of companies are now shied away from this type of controversial imagery. So on one hand, in the corporate sense, there's been some lessons learned, some battles won. On the rhetorical sense of this political moment, it's baffling, it's confusing, and utterly frustrating.
Maribel Alvarez is a professor in the University of Arizona School of Anthropology and the Southwest Center.
Tipped workers have been in the news a lot lately, from the now-failed Prop 138, which would have allowed tipped workers in Arizona to be paid 25% less than the minimum wage, to President-elect Donald Trump's campaign proposal to end taxes on tips. And in today's edition of our week-long spotlight on the country's new multi-generational workforce, we're going to talk about how we got here. Eli Wilson is a sociologist at the University of New Mexico who studies race, work, and social inequality. And he says tipping wasn't born here in America, and it's rooted in class hierarchy, which still persists today. I spoke with him more about tipping in America today, beginning with its European history.
I like to differentiate between tipping as a social practice versus tipping as something that comes wrapped in a type of employment. So tipping as a social practice, you know, it's the history is a little bit unclear, but generally the consensus is it is a practice imported from Europe and came over sometime around the mid-19th century from folks, Americans who had traveled and had relationships to European life and sort of imported that custom, brought it back to the US. And one thing that's important about that history, at least when I think about it as a sociologist, is that it tells us that tipping as a social practice is one that is inherently rooted in social difference and also, in many ways, class hierarchy, right? That is to say, wealthier people distributing small bits of change for some kind of service from generally people of lower social classes. And it's not till a little bit later that tipping really takes hold as a very clearly understood type of work and labor practice.
So let's talk a little bit then about the cultural side of that, right? As you said, you like to separate the two. I wonder, have you noticed, like I have noticed, a cultural shift in how often we tip today, when we're asked to tip, where we're asked to tip? It seems to be kind of driven by the technology, right? Like this question we all see on the screen when you're checking out wherever with suggested tip amounts.
Oh, this is the infamous tip creep.
Yes.
Or as it has become known. Sure. You know, I'm a consumer as well, and it does seem like tipping has just gone to places that it never was before, maybe even a decade ago, right? And when we thought that, we immediately need to think about what seems to be driving this change. And I think that as you mentioned, you know, just now, I think it's very clear that technology, the advent of new technologies, the advent of technologies that are being used in POS or point of sale systems, in many settings that do have tips and that are sort of conducive to customers leaving a tip, we've seen technology kind of fuel that spread. But it's also very important to remember who's behind the technology. And I don't necessarily mean the companies that own that technology. I'm talking about business and business owners that are using these technologies in ways that are favorable to their business. Mm. Right. So when we talk about tip creep, we have to think about whose interests are being sort of met by the spread of essentially customers paying more and more money to workers in the form of tip. That looks very different from, say, wages being paid to those same workers.
That's really interesting. Okay, so let's talk about that side of it, right? Like, how many workers roughly in the U.S. rely on tipping to make a living wage, to survive? Like, that is the way in which their pay structure is set up.
Sure. Well, you know, it's a little tricky to estimate, if you can imagine, because tipping has historically been a kind of gray area. There was once a time not that long ago where one didn't need to report tips, for instance. But right now, estimates are about 4 million tip workers last time I checked.
Wow. Okay. So a lot. And talk a little bit about how the laws around that have changed recently. Like, there are political efforts, it seems, on both sides. We're seeing an initiative here in Arizona that's spearheaded by the Arizona Restaurant Association. It would essentially lower the amount restaurants have to pay tipped workers as long as their tipped salary ends up above the minimum wage by a couple of dollars. Do you see efforts like this around the country? Like, is this a common kind of battle we're seeing?
Well, let me take us back a little bit further to begin. Thinking about the tip minimum wage, or just the minimum wage in general, right? So this was the famous FLSA, so that's the Fair Labor Standards Act, passed in the early 20th century, that really protected workers and established a minimum wage that, of course, employers had by law to pay. Mm-hmm. And what was interesting for the purposes of our conversation is right there during this kind of watershed moment for labor and those and the FLSA passing, there was a carve out, something that was not included in that minimum wage for people working for tips. Mm. And so this, the legacy of this sort of these carve outs and exceptions for tip workers continues on to today. Right. So we talk about what's oftentimes known as the tipped minimum wage rule. That would essentially be a lower minimum wage that employers are legally allowed to pay to workers if they make a certain threshold. And usually that threshold is $30 a month in tips. They can be classified as a tipped worker and paid less by law from their employers. And the thinking is that tips would make up the difference. So there's always been this kind of two-tiered nature of minimum wage, and that's been in kind of on the books for a little over 100 years.
Wow. Okay. So what does this look like today? I mean, what does it do to workers?
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a patchwork of rules. So what does it do to workers becomes a question of, well, where do you live and where do you work?
Yeah.
Right? Currently, there are 8 states, by my last count, that actually have disbanded the tip minimum wage so that employers, regardless of if an employee is tipped or not tipped, need to pay the minimum wage. And there are every other state that has some variation of being able to pay workers slightly less, but of course above the federal tip minimum wage.
Mm-hmm.
So what does this do to workers? Again, depends on where they're working, but let's just assume they're working in a state like Arizona or a state like New Mexico, where I'm currently residing, and employers are able to pay quite a bit less. This creates a lot of uncertainty. Now, sometimes when consumers, you know, your average American who doesn't work for tips thinks about, is this fair, right? Should employers be allowed to do this? They might be thinking about when they go to maybe a restaurant and you have a server or a bartender that you tip, and maybe it's customarily 20% of your bill. And sometimes that's quite a bit of money. And certainly there are many, many, especially servers and bartenders, but other tipped occupations that make quite a bit in tips, such that, you know, one might argue, well, should it really matter if they get paid slightly less minimum wage, right? Their total earnings vastly exceed that. But that's not who I'm thinking about when I think about who might be vulnerable or who is vulnerable to these kinds of carve-outs for folks who are technically tipped workers. Imagine making just over that $30 tipped worker kind of classification.
Mm-hmm.
And imagine that an employer should rightfully subsidize or need to pay them up to the minimum wage in that state. But that's incredibly difficult to do in practice. It's very difficult to sort of oversee and make sure employers are sort of pulling their fair share in the situation that that tipped worker doesn't make enough to meet minimum wage. So there's an incredible amount of research suggesting the risks that workers face when they are subjected to these lower kind of tip credits.
That's really interesting.
Having to work day in and day out in that setting.
All right. We will leave it there for now. That is Eli Wilson, Associate Professor in the Department of Sociology and Criminology at the University of New Mexico. Eli, thanks for coming on. Thanks for explaining the research here to us. This is really interesting.
My pleasure, Lauren. Happy to do it.
Good morning.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Newly re-elected Democratic Pima County Sheriff Chris Nanos is facing a criminal investigation for allegations of election interference this week. It all stems from an ongoing controversy that has not been settled by Nanos' current lead in last week's election results. Just weeks before Election Day, Nanos put his Republican opponent in the race and his employee, Heather Lapin, on administrative leave, as well as an outspoken deputy union leader. And the Pima County Board of Supervisors is not happy about it. Supervisor Matt Hines called for a former censure of the sheriff and for him to step down. But first, the board voted unanimously this week to request an investigation into his actions. It isn't the first time the sheriff has been in this kind of situation, and our next guest is here to tell us more about it. Tim Steller is an opinion columnist for the Arizona Daily Star in Tucson, and he joins us on the line now. Good morning, Tim.
Hey, good morning. How's it going?
Great. Thanks for coming on. So this is a convoluted tale I outlined there. Tell us
first,
where this race stands now, Tim. It's gotten very close in recent days.
Yeah, so, I mean, we thought he, Sheriff Chris Nanos, had been reelected, but actually we came to find out last night that the margin has narrowed to 199 votes.
Right.
That's his lead. And there's still, as of yesterday, last night, there were about 8,500 votes left to count. So.
Wow. Conceivably, down to the wire.
Yeah, conceivably that lead could flip, but we're not sure right now.
Okay, so tell us about the history here. Were you surprised to see the sheriff put his opponent on administrative leave just a few weeks before the election?
Well, no. To make a long story short, I've written a column and I've observed in the past Sheriff Nanos has a tendency to, I think, overreact. He reacts harshly to being crossed at times. And so what occurred in this case was in mid-October, a couple of deputies at a couple of different times dressed up in clothing that looked like deputies' uniforms, mm-hmm. including handcuffs on the back, although they weren't actually their uniforms, and they didn't wear badges. And they stood on busy sidewalks near busy roads and held up signs that said deputies oppose Nanos or that sort
of
thing.
Right.
So that's what prompted. And then the opponent, Heather Lapin, someone posted these photos on the opponent's Facebook page. And so as a result, Sheriff Nanos suspended both the deputy who led this campaign effort and Lapin herself.
Mm-hmm.
She's a lieutenant in the department.
Right. So he says she's crossed a line in that they, you even wrote in your column, right? You know, people who thought that they were in uniform there, even though they weren't.
Yeah, right. I mean, so part of the question is what she did, what role she played in this, because she was not participating in this, but it would, I don't know, stand to reason that she at least is connected to the actions by people who support her.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, but the crazy thing that happened next is, of course, there was a lawsuit.
Mm-hmm.
The sergeant who was suspended sued. And in fact, the federal judge who heard, they sought a restraining order, the federal judge rejected that, but said you gotta adjust these rules and in the sheriff's department to make it more clear what people can do. And in addition, he said that he thought these people violated the Hatch Act by
mm-hmm.
how they behaved that day.
Okay, so this is not the first time though that the sheriff has done something like this. You wrote about what happened in 2016 as well. Tell us what happened then.
Yeah, well, it was another existing, I think, sergeant in the sheriff's department filed to run for the sheriff's position. And at that time, there were different rules in the county. And basically, if there was any sign that this sort of run would interfere with your duties, you would be put on unpaid leave, as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's unpaid, not paid. And so he promptly put this person on leave, although it was kind of something that was up to his discretion. It just goes on. You know, he lost that race in 2016 to a political newcomer, a Republican named Mark Napier,
right,
which is notable in a county that votes ever more reliably Democratic. You know, he was rejected, but then in 2020, he narrowly won in a rematch against the same Republican, Mark Napier.
Right.
So here we are in a similar situation.
Right. And I want to ask you about the political environment that surrounds all of this controversy in Tucson, right? Like, as you say, it's a largely Democratic place. It has elected Republicans, though, in this office before. Should we assume that Nanos, you know, has the edge because he's a Democrat in this race? How do the politics usually play out?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very individual thing. I mean, you see that with like Trump voters apparently voted for Gallego in the state election. I think you see that a lot of Democrats in Tucson chose not to vote for Chris Nanos for various reasons. And I think they include this last minute suspension, which occurred during the period of early voting. I mean, it was right there in the middle of the hot moment of people voting for his race. So he's clearly not as popular as other Democrats. Other Democrats, even if they're unknown, are running away with their races. But he has struggled. He won narrowly, lost narrowly, won narrowly, and is winning narrowly again. But that may flip.
Yeah. Very quickly, last 30 seconds here. You wrote in this column that this only all reinforces the reputation that Nanos has earned of being authoritarian, essentially, in this sense of retaliating against dissenters. What has he had to say about all this?
Well, I mean, he says that's just not the pattern. He says he has retained and even promoted people who campaigned against him, and that, you know, he'll keep doing things, doing what he thinks is right, no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
But he's challenged by the conflict with the Board of Supervisors, which is a whole other topic. And
yep.
he's now going to be under another criminal investigation. They already requested one year or two ago, and now he's going to be under another one.
All right. And we'll watch and see how that all plays out. Tim Staehler, opinion columnist with the Arizona Daily Star, joining us from Tucson. Tim, thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. A new exhibition at ASU explores a set of paradoxical emotions. The show's Sam Dingman has the story.
It was Nikki who made the call to end things. She finally came to me and said she was in love with someone else. Now, I had actually known that for a while, but I kept thinking there was some way I could make her fall back in love with me. And even after we split, I still couldn't bring myself to believe it. I spent months staring at this picture of her standing in front of a jewelry rack, imagining an afternoon where I bought her a necklace and we walked through the park holding hands. Now, that afternoon with the necklace, that never actually happened. It's an alternate reality version of what did happen the day that photo was taken. That was the day that Nikki first told me she was having doubts.
I've got a box of old photographs, mostly pictures of you. And I never look at those pictures anymore.
Eventually, I stopped looking at old pictures and started listening to music instead. Specifically, this one song by the band Trout Fishing in America. It's called You Can't Get There From Here.
You can drive all night long, but you can't get there from here. Well, there's a place I remember.
I have never really understood why those lyrics made me feel better. Logically, they shouldn't. The singer is saying, this place that you're pining for, that you'd be willing to drive all night to get to, it doesn't even exist. But I listened to that song over and over and over again, and it helped. Cadence Gonzalez knows what I'm talking about.
It started with a feeling that I had, and I kind of figured, like, well, surely other people feel this way too. And so...
I mean, that's why I'm here, so...
Yeah.
Cadence and I are standing in the Harry Wood Gallery at ASU. Cadence is wearing all black. Black shirt, black jeans, black shoes, black eyeliner. She's telling me about her thesis project, which is on display here at the gallery. It's an art exhibition called Anamoya, Expressions of Subcultural Longing. And that word, Anamoya, it turns out that is the name for the feeling I used to get when I looked at the necklace picture, and that I still get when I listen to Trout Fishing in America. Anamoya means nostalgia for something you never actually experienced. Cadence discovered the word when she started examining her own sense of longing for a place that doesn't exist.
It started out as an interest in like third spaces. So there's the first place, which is home, second place, which is work, and third place, which is places like bars that you can go to interact with your community. And it's a place where you don't have to think about your work life or anything. It's very casual and it brings you joy.
If the theme song to Cheers just popped into your head, you know what a third space is. A place where everybody knows your name and they're always glad you came. But just like a clean, well-lit bar full of functional alcoholics who speak in perfectly timed wisecracks, real third spaces are hard to find. Cadence knows. She spent years trying.
For me, places that are full of queer people were difficult to find. It's difficult when you live in like Gilbert, Arizona. It's not like you can go out and like be surrounded by a bunch of queer alternative people.
That is part of what led Cadence to dress in all black.
I definitely wear all black all the time. I really like goth culture and fashion. Using fashion to kind of assert yourself as an outsider or like someone who doesn't really, who's not trying to like fit in with like the larger society. And I also feel sort of a bit of imposter syndrome when it comes with this like subculture, and I think that also plays a big part into like this whole theme of my exhibition, is a lot of people still feel like an outsider.
For the exhibition, Cadence put out a call to artists for works inspired by their relationship to subculture and anamoya. This, she suspects, is part of what's behind her generation's embrace of older aesthetics that they weren't even around for. For example, as one of her artists captures, 90s punk.
This one is called Requiem of a Lonely Teenage Punk. And this is a piece that is a lot of patches of black fabric stitched together. And on it, there's tooth floss that makes a drawing of a teenager kind of like moshing in his bedroom that's covered in posters and like the classic kind of idea of like a punk bedroom. And I really like this because it takes inspiration from crust punk patches and like uses that to like make this image of this teenager moshing alone in his bedroom that like in our generation you can feel connected to a sort of a subculture but still be lonely.
What do you make of the fact that they use dental floss to do the illustration?
I think that's really cool. I think it also speaks to the resourceful kind of DIY nature of punk. Where it's like, this is what I have on hand, so I'm going to use it. Really cool. I keep saying cool.
No, I mean, cool is such an interesting word in this context, because cool, you know, it's like a 50s reference that we all just kind of, in a way, cool is sort of like anamoya that has just become shared cultural lexicon, you know?
Exactly. That's why I'm saying it so much.
In one corner of the gallery, Cadence has a table with folded paper and markers. She says it's a place for visitors to express their own associations with the themes of the show.
This one really stood out to me. It says, being over 50 and still raving. Music makes me happy. Being happy makes me dance. At your next rave, say hi to the elders.
Music makes me happy. Being happy makes me dance. It reminds me of my experience with Nikki and Trout Fishing in America. Music makes me remember. Remembering helps me forget.
You know, not everything has to be so deep. I wish I had a deeper meaning for wearing all black other than I really like it.
That's a very interesting idea, like not everything has to be so deep. It turns out is kind of a deep idea, because look at this work that everybody has made based on that.
Yes, everything, I think it's so interesting. It's so complicated, and it's like you can talk about this forever and like kind of never reach an end, and I think that's really cool. But cool. You can dive on.
Anna Moya, Expressions of Subcultural Longing, is on view through this evening at the Harry Wood Gallery at ASU. For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Sam Dingman. That's it for this episode of The Show Podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.